coming to you from the Sherpa Chalet at the top of beautiful downtown Mount Podcastia. It's a special episode of Too Many Podcasts. I'm Jim the Podcast Sherpa, and today it's a special episode where I get to speak with people from the entertainment industry. So get yourself an aisle seat, pop up some popcorn, and get a cold drink ready, and sit back. Don't crunch too loud, or else you'll miss the interview from the Sherpa Screening Room. Hey there, Rebels of the Sherpalution. So nice to have you back here at the Sherpa Screening Room. I'm Jim the Podcast Sherpa, and it's going to be talking about books. Lots of talk about books today. So let me ask you this. Would you like a free book? Well, I can tell you two ways that you can get a free book today. Right now. First one is, of course, with our sponsor, which is Audible, and you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/Sherpa, where there's over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. But what's the second way, you say? Very simple. Listen to my interview today with author Neil Perry Gordon. Neil recently released a book called The Bomb Squad, Clash of the Patriots. And he's got an upcoming book next week. We're going to talk about that. And if you listen to the interview, you'll get the information on how you can get your free book. Okay, bet you can't wait anymore. I know, I'll stop talking. Let's go to the interview. Hello there, Rebels. I am speaking today with an author. His name is Neil Perry Gordon. And it's really interesting about his novels because many of them take place in the past, but are definitely so relevant in the present. And I'm here to pick his brain and discuss some of the stuff that he's written. And we have a special surprise for you at the end of the interview regarding his latest book called The Bomb Squad. And we're going to get into that too. But without any further ado, Neil Perry Gordon. Hey, Neil.
Hi. How you doing? I'm good. Thank you for having me on your show.
Always a pleasure. How long have you been writing?
My first book, historical fiction book, A Cobbler's Tale, came out in October of 2018. So I started obviously writing before that. That was when it was published though. And since then I have had four published, the fourth one being Bomb Squad, and the fifth one, which will be coming out very soon, is going to be called Hope City. And we could talk about that in a little while too as well.
Were there any writers that influenced you when you first started?
Yes, always. I'm always influenced. I mean, that's who you get influenced by. I mean, you don't go out if you want to be, if you want to paint, you're influenced by painters or musicians. You have favorite musicians. How could a writer not be influenced by other writers? So, you know, there's a lot of favorites. My genre is historical fiction. So I tend to go to writers who write that way, like Ken Follett. Is one of the top ones who write historical fiction. But I like other writers like Dan Brown, Stephen King, you know, and then some of the masters, like George Orwell and writers. So that's Ray Bradbury, those type of writers, of course.
Yeah, normally I don't ask my guests about their lineage, but I know your lineage actually plays a huge part in the books that you've written, especially the time period that many of your books are set in. So could you kind of discuss a little bit of your lineage so people maybe have an understanding of where the ideas from the books originally came from?
All my characters are Jewish, number one. Know that they're not religious books, but they are Jewish, Jewish heritage. The first one, A Cobbler's Tale, really is a little bit about my family. It starts off with my great-grandfather, which was true. I mean, they lived in southern Poland, and they emigrated to the United States in 1910. At least he did, and left them there while he came here first to establish himself as a cobbler. And he left his wife, who was pregnant at the time, and three children back in Poland. It wasn't called Poland. It wasn't Poland then. It didn't become an independent country until 1930. But at that time, it was part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And the area that they lived in was called Galicia. The region was called Galicia. And so he came here, established himself. In real life, he stayed here. World War I broke out, and his family got stuck. Our family, my family, got stuck in the basically one of the bloodiest battlegrounds of World War I, in a Jewish shtetl in Galicia. This is what the story is about. I don't want to give too much away, but that gives a little flavor about it. Of course, he came to New York to the Lower East Side, where all the immigrants came, millions of immigrants came during that time. So when I did write that book, 2 years ago, of course, immigration was a top of mind with everybody. It was a big news topic. You know, when I wrote it, it came out, I didn't never made a connection of connecting with, you know, what's going on in the news at the time. But it did, and I got a lot of press because of it. So I got on radio shows, and articles were written about the book, and that people wanted to know my feeling about immigration. So, yeah, as you mentioned at my introduction, you wanted to talk about how these books, historical fiction novels of 100 years ago, relative today, that certainly was relative with my first book, The Cobbler's Tale. Then I wrote Moonflower, which was another historical fiction book, but that took place in New York also, but during when the Dutch controlled New York, when it was called New Amsterdam in the 1670s. And Albany was called Beverwijk. So it was all Dutch controlled. Right at the moment, the story is right when the moment when the English start to come in. And it's a story about a boy, he's half Jewish, half Dutch, and his adventures, and it's a rite of passage type story. So that was called Moonflower. Then there was The Righteous One, which was the sequel to A Cobbler's Tale, which takes place in New York. That is not historical fiction. That is what is called metaphysical fiction, because there I touched on the theme of the journey of the consciousness, the idea that the consciousness it lives forever. So the body dies, you know, at one point in our lives. We dispose of our body, but our consciousness lives on. So I sort of explore that a little bit. I explore Kabbalah mysticism, Jewish mysticism called Kabbalah, in that book as well. And then in the Bomb Squad, we're back into New York, but at the time when my first book came out, but it's 1916 now, and the U.S. is not in World War I, though the war has started. And since the war started, we had a lot of German ships in New York Harbor and a lot of German nationals in New York, and they got they couldn't leave. They shut off shipping, you know, boats going back and forth from across the Atlantic because it was too dangerous. So all these Germans got basically stranded here in the New York metropolitan area, mostly actually on the New Jersey side, on my side of the river. The Bomb Squad is about how Germany was trying to keep the Americans out of the war by distracting them, by blowing things up. So the book begins with an explosion on what's called Black Tom Island, which is about 2,000 feet behind the Statue of Liberty. And it was an armaments depot. And it was a bunch of arms getting ready to be shipped to Russia. Germans found out about it. They blew the thing up. It was an amazing explosion of such enormity that it blew windows out all through Manhattan and all the way down south into Jersey City and even further. That's how powerful the blast was, and that's how basically the book begins. So that's the Bomb Squad. Just got out of paperback. I just got it today, my paperback versions. So the story itself, I'll just finish telling you about what the story is about the Bomb Squad. So it's about two men. I call the subtitle of the book Clash of the Patriots. So I have two men. One is they're both German-American. One is Dr. Harold Schwartz. He is a administrator and doctor of Ellis Island Immigrant Hospital, very prestigious position. He's also a German spy. And he's in cahoots with his father, who was a lifelong friend of Kaiser Wilhelm, who's still in power and running the country, leading Germany into World War I. And he's an arms dealer. So they're conspiring with their German government to blow things up and keep Americans occupied so they won't want to get into the war. On the other side, we have the other patriot, also a German-American, but loyal to America. He's a New York City police detective. His name is Max Rothman, and he's recruited by the British Secret Intelligence Service, known as the SIS, to establish a bomb squad. And this bomb squad will investigate what's going on in the city. Things are blowing up right and left. So that's their mission. So I have these two men. At first, they have some relationship. They do know each other because they both belong to this this club in New York City for Germans. So they do know each other socially, but they don't know they're actually adversaries for a while till they realize who's who. The story goes from New York, New York City, and it does end up for a period of time in Germany, in the city of Cologne and in Berlin. And it's a crime story. It's an espionage story. It's an historical fiction story. And it just got mentioned. There was a website that listed the 15 best crime stories of April 2020. And mine was first on the list. Other really famous writers alongside with me. So that was nice. So that's a little synopsis of the Bomb Squad.
And it's interesting because the subtitle is
Clash of the Patriots.
Clash of the Patriots. And it's also reflective of what goes on today, where even in American politics, where everything has become so polarized, where people feel that they're behind the right person and the other person is completely wrong. And you're with us or you're against us. And in your story, they were literally against each other.
Yeah, and they both believed they were right. They both believed they were patriots, and they were. You know, and they each took their own side. You know, there's that saying that you'll end up on the wrong side of history. And what does that mean? Okay, so those who picked the Germans were on the wrong side of history. They lost World War One, and of course, it ended up perpetuating into World War Two. But yeah, it's being on the wrong side of history. But yeah, we all believe we're right in our cause. You know, and wars have gone on forever with that idea that people should not compromise.
And in your other books, with the Cobbler into the Righteous One, now you kind of transition into about the Jewish religion into a
metaphysical fiction.
Yeah. Was it a smooth transition when you wrote that book, or did you have to really expand the way that you looked at things?
Well, when I wrote the Righteous One, my father just passed away, so I was very interested in the idea of the journey of the consciousness, what happens to us when we pass. So I wanted to have something that I could really look into, hold on to. And when you write about something, you really learn about it. You know, it's like if you want to learn a subject, you teach it. When you write a novel about something, you definitely have to study it, and you definitely learn a lot. So it had me examining that. So that story evolves. I needed to find a vehicle so you could sort of reach out to this consciousness that's out there, and how do you reach out to it being in the human form that we're in? And I figured the best way would be through dreaming. So through lucid dreaming, so knowing you're dreaming in the dream state. So my characters end up actually having their battle. They have the two characters, the good and evil characters, battling out in the dream world.
In Moonflower, it's almost a spiritual thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that book begins, so this young boy, he's 17, and his father is killed, his mother is killed. He ends up living with a Native American tribe, and he does this rite of passage, and he drinks the moonflower, which is seeds from the Datura plant. And it's hallucinogenic. Kids do it now, and it's very powerful. But, you know, he does it under the guidance of a shaman. And the shaman says, before you take this, I want you to write your entire life down, everything you remember, from your first memory to your last. You're 17, she's like 17 years old. So he writes it down on a parchment, and then he takes the moonflower because he's going to lose his memory completely. So he's going to have this document when he comes out on the other side. He'll have this document, and it's going to be his life. But it'll be just words. It's going to be no emotional connection, of course, because he's now forgotten everything. So that's how the story begins. And then he's basically, he's cleansed of all his past, and he's going to make a new life for himself moving forward. So that's how the Moonflower story begins.
Now, with historical fiction, I noticed that if you look on Amazon and you see the reviews of Neil's books, they are incredible. And they're very well beloved by the public and even by the critics as well. I imagine doing that kind of genre with a historical fiction, you must have like an incredible accuracy with the research that you must put into these books before you're writing them.
There's two things that exist today that if they didn't exist, well, I know it didn't exist 20 years ago, I would never have been a writer. One is working on a laptop instead of a typewriter. And two is having Google instead of going to the library. So, you know, that has changed the whole world of what I do, because I'm writing and then I need an idea. I said, well, let me Google that. And then I'll start going on my Google path and I find things and, you know, it's at your fingertips today. So it's much easier. I mean, years ago, using a typewriter and having to research at a library would have made my writing process so much longer and so much more challenging. But people did it. I mean, that's all they knew. So you would have figured it out. But I'm thinking it's a lot easier doing it this way.
I guess with every author, you kind of hope in maybe the back of your mind, because you're probably visualizing it when you're writing out, the movie version of the book. Did you ever see any of your books becoming a movie?
Well, of course, that's every writer's dream, is to have your books become a movie. But, you know, I write with that in mind. You know, I have an editor, and so we talk about that. And she says, just think of your chapters as scenes. And that's how I do it. You know, it's all about communication. So how do I communicate a story to the reader that they can understand and not get caught up in the words so much, but just let it flow? I want to make sure people are entertained as well as educated and informed and enjoying the process of my writing. You know, what's interesting about being a writer in the world of fine art is that, you know, there are different, so what makes up fine art? You have painters, you have musicians, you have sculptors, you have writers. But, you know, when an audience goes to a concert and listen to musicians, they might stay there 2 hours, 3 hours. A Bruce Springsteen concert might be 4 hours, right? But that's a long concert. If you go to a museum, you might spend a couple hours at the museum seeing painting and sculpture and whatnot. But when you read a book, you make a real investment of your time. I mean, you make an investment of weeks and months for some people to finish a book. That's quite a commitment. So when you get critiques back and reviews, like you just mentioned that I get good reviews on Amazon, that's a wonderful feeling to actually experience as someone creating something, you know, just from scratch. So I enjoy that process. I enjoy hearing back from people who've read my book. And I'm never tired of someone going, oh, can we talk about your book? I'm like, yeah. It's one of my favorite topics.
I understand your writing style, you refer to it as organic?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's different ways of writing. One way of writing is writing with an outline. So you actually do, and some writers will write in-depth outlines, 100-page outlines, so they know exactly where the book is going, you know, have a whole structure to it, a whole format. And I don't do it that way. I'll come up with an idea of a story. It's always character-based, because that's always, to me, the most important is the characters. The story is second, because the story is where I take the characters. So I write organic, which means I have an idea where I'm taking them, but I don't know how we're going to get there. So if we're at point A, we have to get to point Z, we're going to be zigzagging, and I'm not going to know how we're going to get there, because I want to make sure that if I'm surprised, the reader will be surprised at the story. So I write in this, what I call this organic way, which is basically without an outline.
And I guess it probably keeps the characters from being cliched too, because it's the idea that's coming right to you as you're writing it, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting about that word cliche in writing. You know, sometimes you want to have some things that are obvious and cliche because it gives a sense of comfort to the reader. They'd say, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. But then you also have to give them stuff they didn't expect. So it's, you know, it's a mixing of those types of things, because, you know, you're offering something to the reader to keep them busy for 400 pages or 80,000 words and keep it flowing. So the worst thing to do is for a reader to be bored and not finish your book and put it down.
Did you consider yourself anything of a history buff when you were growing up?
No, I think I've always enjoyed history. What I like about writing about historical fiction is that it really provides great backdrops to your stories. So, you know, I'll have an idea. Like for Cobblestown, for example, I knew my great-grandparents, where they lived. I knew how they came here. I knew a couple of things about them. I never met them, but I heard stories about them and what went on them, and then some of the things in the book. Now, this is not a true biography of them. I made my great grandfather much more heroic than he really was. I mean, immensely more heroic than he really was. But I was able to go back and then look up events that happened during that time and then tie that into the story. So it adds a lot of color to my stories, a lot of backdrop, and it's fun. I like reading historical fiction myself. So I like to write about what I like to read about. So that's probably why I picked that genre.
And when your great-grandparents came over, they ended up in the garment industry, is that right?
all my great grandparents were all merchants. Today we call them entrepreneurs, right? But back then, they were all Jewish merchants. But growing up in Eastern Europe, you know, in a shtetl, which is a little Jewish village, you had basically two types of people. You had the Torah scholars, who were the intellectuals and would study the Torah, and they were the most honored ones in the shtetl. And then you had the craftspeople, you know, the cobbler, the baker, and the butcher. And those and children of those people ended up going into the same career that their father did, like in the cobbler's tale. So, you know, his father was a cobbler and his son will be a cobbler. So, and then when they came to America, all of a sudden the intellectuals had nothing and didn't have a career. They had nothing to do, while the craftspeople all had businesses to open with great needs. You know, a cobbler in the Lower East Side in 1910 opened his doors. He was busy right away. He had business. You know, what does an intellectual do? Going to write a pamphlet about some political event somewhere? Who cares? Back then, people were just trying to survive. Yeah, maybe I got off on a tangent from what your original question was, but that's part of what I really enjoyed about it.
Well, I guess, you know, having a feel for what went on at that era and the value of these people in society was probably very important too. And I'm sure when your great grandparents did come over, you know, they were building America.
Think of the courage that it took for people to pick up everything they had and come here and have no idea where they were coming. But what they did have back then was interesting, because all the villages created these societies here in New York and the Lower East Side that supported people coming from their hometowns. So when you came here from a hometown, there was a society of other people from your town that were already here. They all contributed money. So when you got here, they found you a job, they found you a place to live. They helped you out when you needed to help, be helped out. And also back then, it was very important to be buried and have a Jewish burial, a proper Jewish burial. So they all had their own cemeteries, these little villages here in America. Lots in Queens and out on Long Island. The land was cheap back then, so they were buying the land up and creating these cemeteries. And what they would do is the families would go and have picnics on weekends to go visit their relatives who passed. So it was a very ritualistic type thing that they did back in that time. So yeah, they came here, and you know, they came with a tough time. We don't know how today things are tough, but under the current circumstances, but you know, they also had a lot of challenges coming here, not speaking the language and not knowing really what life was going to be like.
I guess lots of times with people, it's very often your perspective. Or like you're saying, with your great grandparents, you know, they didn't speak the language. And, you know, when you talk to people today that are living in this country, what we tell them was some of our hardships are nothing in comparison to that. There's just a shift, because everything just moves forward with progress.
Yeah. Well, now we're all experiencing the hardships.
I guess we can't really cry too much when we tell kids, well, you know, when I was growing up, there were three channels on the TV and your phone had a cord on it. Oh, the struggles, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it seemed pretty good to us at the time.
We have a little surprise for the listeners, and I was wondering if you could everybody know.
So you can get, my book comes in paperback and also comes, of course, as an ebook. For your listeners, I would like to offer a free download of my book, free PDF. They can read about the book, and all I ask in exchange is, once they've read it, is to leave a review for me on Amazon. So that's really what helps sell books, is having lots of reviews. You know, when you're an independent bookseller like I am, not only do I have to be a novelist, I have to also be a bookseller. It goes hand in hand. So, you know, when you get on Amazon, you want to make sure you have a lot of reviews, and the better, the more stars, the better. So it's a simple exchange. Send me your email, and my email address is neilperrygordon @gmail.com. And it's Neil Perry, NEILPERRYGORDON @gmail.com. So just send me an email and I'll send one back to you, the PDF, and you have a free download of the book.
And in our show notes, I'll include your email address and actually the Amazon links to your books.
Oh, okay.
If people want to check them out. So, and now we've got the next one coming out, and that one takes place in Alaska.
The next book is called Hope City, and it takes place in a town called Hope, Alaska. And it's 1898, and it's during a gold rush. So it's two boys, two 17-year-old boys who just graduated high school, who live in San Francisco, who convince their parents to let them go to Alaska for the summer to go on this gold rush, become prospectors. And it's basically about a trip down, you know, the rabbit hole, where this boy, these two boys, one is the protagonist. His name is Sam Rothman, but he changes his name to Percy Hope, because his father's like, you know, having a Jewish name is not just a good idea when you go up to Alaska. Maybe you should change it to more of a generic name, more of an American name. So he decides to change his name to Percy Hope. And meanwhile, just about as the boat arrives at Hope, Alaska, it's not called Hope yet because the town doesn't have a name. It's a nameless mining town. So one of the men there, who's one of the actually the antagonist, my evil character, says the next one off this boat will name the city after this, that whoever steps foot off this boat. So it was Percy Hope who was the first to step foot off that boat, and they named the name of the city Hope City. So that's how the book begins, and it's just, like I said, it's a trip down the rabbit hole, and that should be out sometime in June, Hope City.
Before I let you go, I know with the coronavirus going on as we are recording this, I'd always felt that this is probably a great time for writers because they're confined and they can write and they can rewrite and they can edit and then rewrite again. How do you feel about that?
It's given me a lot of time, yes. Sure. I definitely have lots of time to write, and I don't have distractions from work, from my other work. Yeah, so it allows me to focus on writing. And so, yeah, I have plenty of time to spend doing that. So you have to try to do something positive during this challenging time. And so we all come out better on the other side of it. So it's got to keep remaining productive and positive. That's the key.
Truer words were never spoken. Well, he's a writer, so he would know it better than I am. His name is Neil Perry Gordon. Neil, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to Neil Perry Gordon, and best of luck to him on his new literary releases. And if you check the show notes, you can get the information that you will need to get your free book. And thanks for coming down to the show. You can listen to this on your favorite podcast app. Please leave me a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or iHeartRadio. Or you can catch any of my episodes on my website, sherpolution.com. Also, feel free to follow me on social media at sherpolution at Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And speaking of a guy who knows how to blow things up, all right, just go with it for a second. Mr. Bruce, if you don't mind, could you please take us out of here? Thanks. Bye. Viva la Sherpolution.
Thanks for listening to Too Many Podcasts. Please disperse. You can go home now. I said you can go home now. Viva la Sherpolition. Viva la Sherpolition. Yeah, I'll come back now, you hear?